and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, May 16, 2022. The UN mission in Abyei says criminal activities are on the rise in the area.
Since February, the box has been experiencing intercommunal clashes between the Tuish Dinka and Ngok Dinka, mostly over a long-standing dispute in some areas.
And some traders from East African countries operating businesses in the South Sudanese capital Juba say immigration officials still stalk them for work permits.
We are aware that the visas have been waived off, but particularly when you move from Uganda coming to South Sudan, most of our people are coming on the ground that the visas have been waived. But unfortunately, by the time you reach to Juba, you've already taken off something like $15.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Interim Security Forces for Abyei area says there is a surge in criminal activities within the area in the past 2 weeks. UNISFA says despite efforts to maintain peace and security in the region, acts of violence are being executed by criminal elements. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
UNISPA spokesperson Daniel Adereka says the security situation can be described as unpredictable due to an upsurge of armed attacks against civilians and UN security personnel in the disputed territory of Abyei.
Since February, the box has been experiencing intercommunal clashes between the Tuish Dinka and Ngok Dinka, mostly over a long-standing dispute in some areas in the southern part of the box. UNIFA expresses grave concerns about this recent upsurge in violence and calls on the parties to work with UNISFA to find a lasting solution that will bring about peace and stability within the box.
Adereka says UNISPA has engaged in relentless dialogue with the governments of Sudan and South Sudan and has reached out to the paramount chiefs of Ngok Dinka and the Meseria communities, urging their cooperation in maintaining peace in the region.
UNISPA has adjusted its position to quell violence in the box by consolidating its forces in the hotspots areas, and also has encourage engagement of the traditional leaders with a view to finding lasting solutions to the spate of violence that is being experienced.
UNISPA says it will continue to ensure the freedom of movement of locals, mount regular snap checkpoints to deter criminals, and prohibit locals from carrying illegal arms. In March, dozens of people were killed and many others injured when suspected armed militia from Tuish County of Warab State attacked citizens in a net market in Abyei due to a dispute over land ownership. The incident prompted President Salva Kiir to form an 11-member panel headed by Vice President for Service Cluster Hussein Abdulbagi to investigate the root causes of the conflict between the Ngok Dinka and the people of Tuish County. On Friday, following a cabinet meeting, Information Minister Michael Makwe announced the government of South Sudan would send SSPDF forces to curb rising insecurity in the Abyei administrative area.
The president briefed us about the Abyei situation. That is the skirmishes also between the Ngok of Abyei and the Tuik Mayadi. It was on the 3rd, the 4th, the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th that all these crises started again, and there was a lot of violations, a lot of fighting with and sometimes without the intervention of the UNMISS forces there. Despite their intervention, they could not resolve any problem, and as such, it is decided that the SPLF forces should be sent to the site in order to control the situation.
Makwe says the decision was made after fresh fighting broke out earlier this month in Warab State, where he says UNISFA failed to protect citizens and their property in the area. Makwe says the cabinet will strengthen the investigative committee formed by President Kiir last month to bring about peace between Ngok Dinka and Tuik communities. The spokesperson of Sudan Armed Forces, Nabil Abdallah, says Abyei has been a special case under the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement and its security is under UNISPA. Abdallah says any deployment of additional forces should be done only when it is agreed by the governments of both Sudan and South Sudan.
The opinion of the Sudanese army is it is no need to deploy troops in this area by each of the two countries, but if there is any problem, even if it is an internal problem between tribes in Abyei, this issue should be discussed between the governments in the two countries and to try to solve it without using troops.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to Sudanese ambassador to South Sudan, Jamal Malik, for comment, but his phone was switched off. In recent months, violence has intensified in the contested region despite the presence of UN peacekeeping forces in the area. More than 40 civilians, including women and children, were killed and many others injured in separate incidents after suspected armed Mysteria Arab nomads from neighboring Sudan invaded the area last month, according to Abyei authorities. Abyei straddles Sudan and South Sudan's borders. In 2011, when fighting erupted in Abyei, Khartoum and Juba agreed to allow a neutral peacekeeping mission to foster security in the area until a political solution was reached. The area is shared by the Mysteria Arab nomads from the north and the Ngok Dinka. UNISPA monitors the border area between the north and the south and is authorized to use force in protecting civilians and humanitarian workers. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
A Sudanese analyst is downplaying the significance of a statement by the G7 foreign ministers urging Sudanese authorities to end arbitrary arrests, detentions, and gender-based violence against protesters. The G7 foreign ministers said in a weekend communique that the restoration of credible civilian-led government is vital for the resumption of economic support and international debt relief to Sudan. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
In the communique, the foreign ministers of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, the United States of America, and the High Representative of the European Union called for the return of civilian-led transitional government in Sudan to pave the way for an inclusive democracy in the country after the October 2021 military coup. At the end of their meeting in Germany, the G7 officials urged an end to violence, including sexual and gender-based violence against protesters, the immediate release of all those unjustly detained, and an end to what the foreign ministers called arbitrary arrests and detentions. The statement also stressed the importance of justice for victims and survivors of violence in order to achieve reconciliation and called for an immediate lifting of the state of emergency in Sudan. The minister said Sudanese military leaders need to show they are committed to a peaceful democratic Sudan and urge civilian actors to find common ground on key negotiation issues to take back the reins of a civilian-led government. Sudanese researcher and a political analyst Attahir Hassan Attahir says blaming Sudan's military leaders for Sudan's problems at this time will not help the people of Sudan realize the aspirations of the revolution, which was built on freedom, peace, and justice. Hassan says the G7 countries should support consultations led by the United Nations, the African Union, and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development to help Sudanese leaders return to the path of a democratic transition.
Since there's already an African and regional effort to bring different Sudanese forces together to a peaceful settlement, they should just support this effort. If the G7 countries are serious about a peaceful solution and the stability of South Sudan, it would be appropriate to provide the ongoing effort with logistical and economic support.
Hassan says the statement will only bear fruit if the G7 puts equal pressure on the military and civilian leaders to engage in a genuine dialogue and restore the path to a democracy.
If the civilian component would accept and engage in direct negotiations with the military, that would be great. they need to accept that the military component is an important part in the political process in Sudan. Blockage of dialogue and putting more demands will not help the two components at the moment.
Haj Hamad, a Sudanese political science lecturer at Khartoum University, says the G7 statement alone will not end the military power in Sudan. Hamad says the military component has not been able to prove it is capable of governing Sudan and provide citizens with basic services over the past 7 months since the October 25th military coup. He says the situation has deteriorated at all levels.
Unfortunately, the statement is this. Is still far away from what the resistance committees are demanding, ending the military coup. No way, I think, for the people in Sudan to accept any kind of any political role for the military.
Last week, representatives of all pro-democracy Sudanese groups known as resistance committees who reject the current military-run government announced a political charter dubbed Charter for the Establishment of People's Power, which lays out a 2-year transitional period. The charter does away with the 2019 document that established a military-civilian partnership in the transitional government and demands a civilian-run government. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Some Ugandan traders in South Sudan say immigration officials continue to harass and extort money from traders who hail from the East African community. The East African Community Market Protocol provides for free movement of individuals, goods, and workers across the regional bloc. A South Sudanese immigration official says he is addressing the concerns of the Ugandan traders. For VOA News, Sheila Pony reports from Juba.
Traders in South Sudan say the country has been slow to adopt the EAC Common Market Protocol, exposing traders from neighboring countries to harassment regarding immigration documents. Philmon Bwanga is Secretary General of the Ugandan community in South Sudan.
We are aware that the visas have been waived off, but particularly when you move from Uganda coming to South Sudan, most of our people are coming on the ground that the visas have been waived. But unfortunately, by the time you reach to Juba, you've already taken off something like $50. They tell you you are most welcome here, but you have to pay some $5,000 for registration.
Ugandan and South Sudanese immigration officials met with the Ugandan traders last week to hear their complaints. The Ugandan traders say, although South Sudan joined the East African community back in 2016, the country has not adopted the regional bloc's common market protocol, making it difficult to traders to move from one place to another and conduct business without being charged additional fees. Speaking at the meeting, Ugandan trader Juliet Namlondo outlined some of the challenges Ugandan traders face, including female traders.
One, a housemate gets burnt, but the person came with his passport or her passport. Eventually, the place gets burnt. Don't expect that person to have anything. It means he or she is going to remain illegal undocumented, but not because he came in as a slogan person. Secondly, we have a problem of theft. They are stealing bags. They are breaking cars and stealing documents, bags and everything. It has become worse to the Department of Immigration. Even officers who are undisciplined had got an advantage of using the migration system to also become and pretend that they are migration officers.
Taha Usman, another Ugandan trader, says South Sudan immigration officials often charge Ugandan traders exorbitant fees in the name of temporary residence permits.
We need our money to be accounted for well. If I pay 20,000, you write on the receipt 20. So, we beg you to bring for us a clear document. Someone doing this need to pay this money. So that we know all of that, then we will not go into problems with your officials.
Ugandan trader Julius Ogola says it is not unusual for South Sudanese immigration officers to arrest Ugandans for a lack of documents. Ogola is calling for human treatment of foreign traders regarding the enforcement of immigration laws.
We need to treat one another with some level of dignity. Some of us, we are here, we have intermarried with the people from South Sudan, and we have all the required documentations. But it can be on that bad, fateful day that you have not moved with all the documents that are required.
At the same meeting, Major General Apollo Kasita, who heads Ugandan's Directorate of Citizenship and Immigration Control, told Ugandan traders operating in South Sudan that he will work with the government of South Sudan to streamline the East African Community protocols.
All the issues that you have raised will be addressed. But I will tell you this, nation building is not an easy thing. We take baby steps, we collapse. But the question is, do you stay down or do you come up again? Call your people, liaise again, talk again over the same issues, and you'll find the way forward.
General Atem Marolbiar, who runs South Sudan's Directorate of Civil Registry, Nationality, Passport and Immigration, says he will take strain action against any immigration officer who harasses and extorts money from foreign traders.
So let us protect ourselves and let us respect the human right. So let us go out with a policy, that policy of deliver the service to the people without a border.
Biar ordered immigration officers in South Sudan to hold random arrests of Ugandans and other nationals residing in the country. He also advised the Ugandan community in South Sudan to avoid taking part in demonstrations as a way to express their concerns, but rather focus on finding an amicable solution through dialogue. For VOA News, I am Sheila Oponi in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Somalia has a new president. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your most valuable possession?
My valuable possession right now will be my laptop, because I have a lot of confidential documents on it that are very dear to me and I can't afford to lose right now.
I think my smartphone that my dad bought for me, yeah, I treasure it so much because it was so expensive and I was so happy.
Being in school means so much to me. Yes, I know I've not yet finished, but I'm struggling to reach there because I know it is important to me and it will be something good to me.
My most valuable possession is a photo I took with an important personality in the entertainment industry, and it's an important possession to me because anytime I look at it, it encourages me and inspires me to attain higher heights.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Former Somali leader Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud won the presidency again on Sunday in a vote by parliamentarians held at the airport in a hangar in the capital Mogadishu. Mahmoud toppled a crowded field of 35 aspirants, including incumbent President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo and former President Sharif Sheikh Ahmad. The United Nations-backed vote was delayed by over a year due to disagreement in government. The vote also took place during Somalia's worst drought in four decades and against a background of attacks by Al-Shabaab militants, infighting among security forces and civilian rivalry. VOA's Somali Service Senior Editor Harun Maruf spoke with my colleague Jackson Vunganyi about the elections.
Well, this is because the Somali leaders have not agreed on election law. They have not agreed on completing the constitution without having a defined election model written on the constitution. It has forced the country to go and hold an indirect election. An indirect election is a process that begins with clan elders who select what we call delegates. The delegates elect lawmakers, and the lawmakers elect the president. And that is the process that today led to the re-election of Hassan Sheikh Mahamud, who was previously president in between 2012 and 2017. He defeated the incumbent Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo. It was a rematch of the same final round election in 2017 when Farmajo defeated Mahamud.
Okay. And how did President Farmajo, President Abdullahi Mohamed, who is usually known as Farmajo, how did he do this time around? Did he enjoy any advantages of incumbency?
There was a three-round voting. In the first round, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo got 59 votes. He came second. He was only beaten by the leader of Puntland Regional State. In the second round, where top four candidates competed, Hassan Sheikh Mahamud, the former president, finished first with 110 votes. Farmajo came second again with 83 votes. And the president of Puntland came third, and former Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre came fourth. But according to the election rules, top two progressed to the third round. And in the third round, Hassan Sheikh Mahamud soundly defeated Farmajo 214 against 110 votes.
And what would you say were some of the surprises in the election?
The surprises was that the former president, Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, who was expected to reach the final, according to the expert opinions, was eliminated in the first round. The surprising candidates were the president of Puntland, who finished top in the first round, and the former Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre, who finished fourth in the first round. That was a surprise. The other surprising was that this election was the closest election we have ever had. There were only 13 votes separating the top three candidates in the first round. And the top five candidates performed unbelievably very competitive, and they were very close to each other.
That was the senior editor of VOA Somali Service, Haroun Maruf, speaking to my colleague Jackson Vunganyi here in Washington. Still in the Horn of Africa, drought is not new to the area, but experts say the record heat killing crops and cattle across Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia has underscored the increasing frequency of drought due to climate change. Linda Giftash reports from Ethiopia.
Hawo Abdi Wale has lived through many droughts in her 70 years of life. But until now, she says she's never seen four consecutive rainy seasons fail. Wale says she has seen a big difference. In her early years, she says people used to see more rains and animals produce more milk. There is a big, big difference. The World Food Program is helping her village not only survive the crisis, but rebuild for the long term. They're digging meter-wide semicircle holes in the barren soil to capture runoff water when rains return so that grass can grow more effectively and feed their surviving livestock. Forward-looking interventions are desperately needed. Scientists say climate change is the culprit for these more frequent severe conditions. Abubakar Saleh Babakar is with the World Meteorological Organization in Ethiopia.
The climate in this region is driven by what is happening in the neighboring ocean. There are studies that indicate that this is the fastest warming part of the tropical ocean system. So it is warming rapidly during the past 100 years. And this warming, as I said, it is associated with the dryness of the marsh June season.
It also results in flooding when the rain does return. These events aren't just examples of climate change, but inequality. Haptamu Adam is a climate policy expert in Addis Ababa.
When you compare from the emission level from our contribution to the climate change, it is very incomparable because most of the emissions are emitted from developed countries.
Yet developing countries like Ethiopia don't have the funds to fight the effects. The World Meteorological Organization estimates that sub-Saharan Africa will need up to $50 billion annually to adapt to climate change. Without it, the number of people displaced and in need of aid will only continue to rise. Ali Hussein is with the World Food Program in the Somali region.
We need to build the community resistance to these shocks. And in that line, we want to put more emphasis on these regreening activities, such as half moons, to regenerate this dry desert area to become a greenland in the future, which can be more useful to both communities and as well as livestock.
These projects around the Somali region are showing success and could be replicated to help more people. Ibrahim Korbad Farah is an elder of a village that saw its land restored with the construction of a channel that is effectively diverting streams and rainwater. He says they've experienced numerous advantages. They're now able to farm and use the grass for livestock, as well as thatches for their houses. He says they also use the water for drinking, especially for the livestock. While adaptation is crucial to communities' health and survival, climate scientists warn reducing emissions remains a priority in preventing even worse conditions in the future. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Gode, Ethiopia.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now end the show with Jamnazi Africa and the song, I'm Not Sober. I've been listening to Jamnazi Africa and the song I Am Not Sober. I'm John Tanza in Washington and very sober. Thanks for taking your time to be with us this evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.